Okay, let's move on then to paper 11.
Yep.
One heap.
Please go ahead.
This paper addresses analysis of implementation issues in IFRS 11. At the November 2013 meeting, the committee identified two priority issues among various implementation issues involving IFRS 11. The two issues are stated in paragraph 3 of this paper. This paper only addresses the first priority issue, and we will address the second priority issue and other issues at a future meeting. The first priority issue is whether the assessment of other facts and circumstances should be based on contractual and enforceable terms, which analysis 1 of this paper deals with. We also address 4 other supplementary issues relating to the assessment of other facts and circumstances, which analysis 2 of this paper deals with. In analysis 1, we noted that there can be 2 views. View A says that the assessment of other facts and circumstances should be based on enforceable rights and obligations. And view B says that it does not need to be based on contractual or other legal terms, and the assessment includes intent, business needs, and practice. We examined the relevant paragraphs of IFRS 11 and other standards. As you see, paragraph 41 on page 15 of this paper, some paragraphs of the standards can be read to support view A, and others can also be read to support view B. This means that there may be a potential conflict between the requirements in IFRS 11, possibly leading to divergent interpretations in practice. Accordingly, we think that it is important for the committee to reduce diversity by making clear which view is appropriate. This is also important because conclusions about IFRS 11 issues may depend on a conclusion of this issue. Consequently, we recommend that the committee take this issue onto its agenda. In analysis 2, we examined the 4 supplementary issues. These issues are denoted as issue 2, 3, 4, and 5 in paragraph 44 of this paper. Issue 2 relates to a circumstance where output is sold to investors at a market price. Issue 3 relates to third-party financing. Issue 4 relates to the nature of output sold to investors. Issue 5 relates to whether the assessment of the output should be based on volume or monetary value when assessing whether investors are taking substantially all of the output. For issue 2 and 4, we think that judgment is necessary to determine the classification of the joint arrangement, and also think that conclusions of the assessment would vary depending on a conclusion for issue 1, which we examined in analysis 1. For issue 3, we think that the condition, the third-party financing, would not affect the assessment of other facts and circumstances. For issue 5, IFRS 11 is clear that when assessing whether all output is purchased by investors, the output should be based on monetary value rather than physical quantities. On the basis of this, our analysis, we think that IFRS 11 provides sufficient guidance for these issues. Consequently, we do not recommend the committee take these supplementary issues onto its agenda. Thank you.
Okay, shall we divide this into examination part 1 and examination part 2? Is that the best way to do this?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
So for issue number 1, your recommendation is yes, we should add it to the agenda because we think the standard admits potentially 2 different views. Michael, this was an area on which at one point the staff had developed educational guidance, was it not?
That's right, yes.
And the outcome of that, the educational guidance, if memory serves me, supported View A.
It did, yes. So that educational guidance supported View A. It looked at a number of examples to illustrate the application of View A. And the reason for the staff's conclusion that View A was the appropriate one was when looking at all of the guidance, so all of the different paragraphs that are set out in this paper together, then we felt that was the predominant view that IFRS 11 led us to. When we did a review or external review, we got a certain amount of feedback, a fair amount of feedback, just questioning whether that was the only way of reading the standard, which really is what is bringing us back to the issue that's being analysed in Analysis 1 in this paper today. Scott?
I thought IFRS 11 was clear that what we are going for is rights and obligations. You evaluate other facts and circumstances beyond the legal and contractual agreements to see if they create rights and obligations. I think the standard is actually quite clear on that, so I'd have answered issue one with what I think was View A. Now, the fact that when you look at other facts and circumstances, you're looking to see if they create rights and obligations, I don't think that makes it an easy analysis, because I think the standard does lay out that sometimes these other facts and circumstances create rights and obligations through what I'll call indirect means. And that's a lot harder than just sticking to the contracts, which would say it directly. But I do think the standard is clear that all of your evaluations are trying to figure out whether the joint operators have rights and obligations related to the assets and liabilities of the joint operations.
So to clarify, in your view, the word enforceable as a modifier to rights and obligations is not necessary.
Well, I think the word enforceable, you know, kind of brings to mind by whom, right? Is it by third parties or is it by the joint operation? And I think the standard does make clear that it doesn't have to be enforceable by third parties.
Yeah.
So, you know, if it is the joint operation that can say, you have an obligation to cover all my costs, now give me money, that's good enough to create an obligation. That's not how I've written the standard, but I think that's the way it is written. So I think it does have to be enforceable, but not by third parties.
Laurent?
I agree with Scott. I think that the issues I see in practice about how to assess the criteria of other facts and circumstances is not really the issue that you have addressed in the paper. I also think that I would have come to View A by reading the standard, and I'm not sure, and you have footnotes, I think it's on page 16, that taken as a whole, it would have led you to View A. So I kind of agree, and I was questioning myself, so you were thinking of an interpretation, but what type of interpretation would that be? I wasn't able to understand the type of interpretation you would do. So I'm more like Scott in saying that I think I could have got to View A with the standard as it is. The real issues I have in practice about how to assess other facts and circumstances is what Scott described, is to have direct rights, indirect rights. Do I need to have direct rights or direct obligations? Or if I have indirect one, to what extent do I accept indirect ones? And for instance, the standard says or gives one example where it is concluded that you have a joint operation treatment, even if you have a legal entity, that's when the partners take substantially all the output from the joint arrangement. The key question we have is there any other example? And if so, could you give us an insight of what other example you could have to illustrate that you have rights to your assets and obligation for the liabilities? Because, or if we can't find an example, should we rather say, well, the only situation where you might have rights to the assets and obligation to the liabilities is only when the partners take all the output? I think these are the type of issues we are facing currently. Exactly as Scott said, when it is not completely direct, or to what extent do you have facts and circumstances that in substance create direct rights or direct obligations? And how far do you push that reasoning? That's the real difficulty we're facing with today.
Martin, John, Tony?
I agree with Laurence. I mean, here in your type of issue, I would ask the question, well, what is with a kind of, say, bargain purchase option, where I have no obligation at all to take anything, and this is also mentioned here in the paper, but, the pricing is calculated in such a way that it would be always favorable for me. So under ordinary economic, development, I will put always acquire all the output. Is that then, or under such a construction, am I in another situation as I would have to acquire everything? So this we probably have to consider. The other question then is, it is necessary or is it not intended, probably, to have a link to the understanding of IFRIC 4? Because there also I have to do a kind of assessment. And is the assessment what I do there with certain terms, expressions and philosophies in a way equivalent, or is it something completely different? And I believe we should find, something to give some guidance to find the right way there.
John, Tony, Andrew?
I agree with what Scott said. I think the analysis in the paper seems to me to overstate the case for view B. Reading B32, I think, has to be read in the context of B31 and B30, which both refer to rights and obligations. So it's all about identifying whether other facts and circumstances give you rights and obligations. I think the focus on legal and enforceable is not really necessary, so I agree with that comment. I think you're looking for rights and obligations. And it seems to me that even in B31, when it talks about the output, taking all of the output, it talks about arrangements that prevent the entity from selling the output to third parties. So it seems like even that has some type of enforceability about it, because you're preventing this separate legal entity, which is the joint, in which the joint operation is housed, from being able to deal with third parties. So I would have got to view A by reading the standard and so I don't think it needs to be taken on by the committee.
Tony?
Yeah, I guess I share many of the same thoughts, that I'm not sure accounting is typically affected by unenforceable rights or obligations. So I'm just not sure how I would have got to view B so I'd be in much the same place. I would echo what Laurence said. I'm not sure this is the issue with other facts and circumstances. I think the challenges that exist in practice around other facts and circumstances are that there is a single example and not much more articulation around what other facts and circumstances actually means. So do you, for example, take into account the purpose and the design of the arrangement, which is what you would do if you were thinking about control in IFRS 10? So why was it set up this way? Does the way it was set up create rights and obligations? what does the example where the participants are entitled to take or required to take all of the output mean? How do you interpret output? So I think there are some much broader and more difficult questions, but I don't think this one is really that much of an issue. I think you would typically get to you don't account for something unless it is enforceable.
Andrew?
Well, I just tend to think that there is the potential to tighten up the drafting of the standard to clarify this question about enforceability. And just for example, if you look at the flowchart summarising the assessment process, you've actually already assessed the contractual terms before you get on to the other facts and circumstances, which sort of implies that we're looking for something that we could include things that are non-contractual. Another point is that we are dealing here with a joint arrangement. So if there's something in the agreement that says that the joint arrangement can't provide output to third parties, that the two joint arrangers have agreed between them, they can just change that. So that has no substance. So, but like others who've spoken overall, I think this isn't really the issue. I think what people are craving is just more guidance, but better articulation of how the board believes these other facts and circumstances create rights to the underlying assets and obligations for the liabilities. And like Martin, I was just in my contrasting IFRS 11 with IFRIC 4, and I won't say which one I find preferable, but IFRIC 4 has got significantly more specific guidance, detailed guidance on how an obligation to purchase output from an asset is deemed to create an obligation or a right to the underlying asset. And that's before we've even considered the liability side. So, you know, I wouldn't disagree with clarifying this question, but I don't think it's the main question.
I was looking to board members, and I think Chung Wu gets off the hook because he wasn't around to vote on this one. But
yeah, I'd like to say something, but I was dying to talk. I'm sorry. Maybe Marie has some comments.
Let's let Marie in here first.
Okay. So I think even if I do agree it's not exactly the question we have on other facts and circumstances, I think even a reduction on QA, if it's what everybody thinks, might be helpful because it will, you know, maybe an expectation gap which exists today will not exist maybe anymore. And I think in the staff paper we had the impression that all output should go to the partner, and I don't know if it's what's the only example the board has in mind or the staff, and if it's the case, maybe it will be important to say that as well, because it's where the question is afterwards when you say it's contractual.
Yeah, Patricia, and then Chung Wu.
Say something. I wasn't on the board for the full development of IFRS 11, but I was there more or less at the end. And my understanding of what other facts and circumstances was there for, it was certainly there for the example, right? But I think the problem that the board was facing was that there were so many varieties of these arrangements out there, and that it was impossible to sort of ring fence it, and other facts and circumstances was there to say, you've got to look to everything that's there and see if the facts and circumstances actually change in some way the rights and obligations that appear to be the contractual rights and obligations, but the facts and circumstances taken together have changed the nature of those rights and obligations. But I think we didn't want to be too specific because there was just so many different combinations and permutations of these types of arrangements out there that you couldn't possibly address them all or conceive them all. And that was my understanding.
Chung Wu and then Alan.
Yes, okay. How about the paragraph 13B? And the staff is proposing some other possible other facts and circumstances that's different from terms of a contractual arrangement.
So Andrew, in your case, it is, these are examples are not so enough to interpret this other terms and conditions, maybe. So you want more example, more illustrations.
Well, personally, I struggle with exactly the rationale for how taking the output is deemed to create rights to the underlying, all the underlying assets and obligations to the for the underlying liabilities. Taking the output creates a right to the output and an obligation to pay for the output. That's, I can get that far, and there's a piece missing that then connects that up with the underlying assets of the arrangement and liabilities of the arrangement. So that's where I think there's scope to just clarify the board's thinking somewhat.
Alan?
I've got to be careful here because I know what we meant and I know what the words say. So I'll give you a bit of a flavour of what we meant anyway, because if the words don't capture this, I think that's part of the problem. I agree with, and I'm actually relieved to hear everybody say the rights thing is clear. I can't see any other way of going there than saying it's all about rights and obligations, and I think that's quite clear at the standard. I also accept that there could be quite a bit of judgment in terms of how those other facts and circumstances affect it. The reason there's only one example in there is because we only took one example of the board because we anticipated this would not be a very common thing. In just about every case, once you've got in a JV, inside an entity, we nearly had a rebuttable presumption that said once you're in there, it's just a JV. Our worry was that you could do, and I'll explain this particular example, Andrew, about the consumption. Our worry was that you could then set up an entity, stick inside it some debt and one asset, and you don't say we've got the right to half the asset, you say we've got the right to consume half the output, and you've got the right to consume half the output. There are no other parties involved. By consuming the whole of the asset over its lifetime 50-50, it's exactly the same as having the right to the asset 50-50. But you've just predetermined everything that's going to come out and you're going to consume. And we consider that to be a valid exception. Now, if we'd had a rebuttable presumption, you could actually sit back and say, no, I don't think I can rebut that presumption, and you park your debt there with the other asset. But if you actually make people look at the underlying economics, then you would actually pull that example out and say, just because I don't say I own or control half the asset, well, actually I'm going to take half of all the output over its life, then I've got the same circumstances. We had in mind two examples. One was two people running a factory together, running separate factories, but they had one common, say, wrapping machine or bottling machine that they used together. They expected to run the whole thing for its whole life. So rather than specify the asset, they just ran and consumed half each. And the other one was something where two parties went together and stuck inside it something like a mine or some sort of mineral, and they expected to take exactly half each. We thought there were too many structuring opportunities, which is why we moved away from a rebuttable presumption. We didn't develop other examples because we didn't have others in mind. So we thought it was expected to be narrow. Now, my understanding from what I'm hearing is that people are saying, as you mentioned, and I've heard this expressed, as soon as you have a supply agreement, then it's a joint operation. But I would argue that you can have a joint venture. A supply agreement is a supply agreement. Now, if that supply agreement trumps everything else, that's okay. But I think it's easier to see that with a single asset than it is to see it with multiple assets. The next thing is to say, where do we go? Because
I was hoping you'd take us.
This is a really difficult situation, because the other thing that not only did we have difficulty when we developed those examples that we were going to put out as educational or illustrative examples in terms of their nature, a lot of people said to us, we think we agree with the answer, but you can't do that without a due process, because what you're doing is narrowing the way some people are interpreting it. So there was the process about whether we were in fact interpreting IFRS 11. The second thing was, we actually received a due process complaint from one company that said, we haven't seen the material, but don't you dare do anything. We're in our first year of application. If this starts to come out or you create uncertainty about how this thing applies, and Europe's a case, 1 January 2014 takes effect, if we start to fiddle around and mess around with what it is, that's just as disruptive. So there are no simple solutions here, but one of them would be to put out a rejection or just decision on the basis that it is clear that it's about rights and obligations. However, the Interpretations Committee accepts that there can be a lot of judgment around how you interpret those other facts and circumstances. Then what the ISB, I think, ought to do is think about timing of its post-implementation review. Now, if we actually accelerate that, we normally say that it would be 2 to 3 years after application. But there's nothing stopping us doing some initial review to see whether or not we've got much wider divergence than around how that's being interpreted. But I think that the anchoring around the rights and obligations should get rid of these views that saying, oh, just because we've got a supply agreement, it's clearly a joint operation. That's the sort of thing we need to try and minimise anyway. Get back to those things where judgment's involved. Because there are no simple solutions then. If it is a matter of judgment, you know, Laurence is saying, well, why not other examples? Well, exactly. Then we'd have to say, well, what other factors should you think about in terms of developing your judgments? And I think that's a slightly broader project.
Let me experiment here, since I'm having so much luck since lunchtime anyway. What I think I hear you saying, Alan, is I start with a contract that says I have these rights, Michael has those rights. If there were nothing else, then I would hope that contract would take me where I need to go. Mm-hmm. Now, something else comes up, or there's some other factor that I have to consider. If it doesn't change my rights and Michael's rights, not a problem. The only issue is, does this other fact and circumstance somehow change my interpretation of what my rights and obligations are? That's, all of a sudden, that sounds enormously simplified, but that seems to me to be the issue, isn't it?
There was, by the way, one other situation, and that's the Spanish UTE was our sort of our classic case, where because we don't have a common definition within IFRS of what a legal entity is or a separate entity, it's quite a loose notion. We know that there are some cases where a legal structure exists that has the right to do things, and often in the Spanish UTE case was put in bids for public contracts. And we were told that in many cases two companies had to get together, form the special entity, and they were required to bid together, but essentially everything went right through the thing. It was clear that one did one and one did the other, but it had to have this entity. That was clearly going to be a joint operation as well. You kept those things separate. Those are the things we're trying to capture in there.
All right, let's just go from this direction this time. John?
Oh, sorry, ma'am.
Oh, you didn't. Laurence?
What you propose, Ellen, will not help me solve the diversity in practice. I think there is a need for clarification whether for establishing whether you have rights to the assets, you must have the right to the physical output.
Put an example. Let's say you have two entities who want to operate together to, say, construct a plant for a client. Okay, they always operate together to construct plants around the world. So they will find a client with which they will establish a contract, define everything, they will provide and construct everything. It's all of them, all the financing is provided by them. Except that in order to construct that plant in some specific countries, you must have a legal entity. In some other countries, you won't have that legal entity. The fact that you have a legal entity in one country may make it that you don't have the legal right on the WIP that will be carried by the legal entity. Albeit in the way those companies operate, it's the same. So do you agree that for those project entities, or are you saying that for those project entities,
despite the fact that there is a legal entity here, because it's all, you know, it's, they are all liable, let's say it's an unlimited liability entity, they are all liable for the liabilities, except that that legal entity will get the cash from the client, and the cash obviously will then go back to the partners. What I described to you, where everything is settled even before you set up the legal entity, is this sufficient? Are these other facts and circumstances that you take into account that enable to demonstrate that you have rights to the assets and obligation to the liabilities of that entity? That's the type of question. The other type of question, and I would like the committee to discuss, is indeed, can there be situations where indeed there isn't a contract that partners will take all the physical output? Is it a requirement that the partners take all the physical output to get to GO classification, joint operation classification, when you have a legal entity?
So there are two issues there, I think, but two fact patterns, and I think it depends. And the first one, when you describe you've got two parties who are working together, which is closer to the Spanish UTE, but in this case it is a substantive entity that they're working through, so it has legal boundaries around that. When I say it depends, we're aware of some cases where they'll be very specific about what they retain rights to, for example, through their contracts. And I'll oversimplify this, but imagine you've got two partners are building, constructing together, and they have slightly different expertise, which is why you don't want to have two concrete people going in together. One's doing the concreting, one's doing the plumbing and fittings and things like that. So if things go wrong, that party gets their fittings back and they have rights to claim that and so on. And it's very clear from the contractual relationships which bits they can claim and so on. That's much getting much closer to those contracts that are establishing quite clear legal rights or obligations for all the streams that go in there. And that's getting closer to breaking through the legal barrier, and you've got to have a joint operation. But a contract can be very specific about that. I thought the other facts and circumstances were more of the cases where you don't establish those clear rights, but you're looking at something else, and that was the consumption type thing, where we say, well, I haven't got rights to those things, but I'll take this or I'll take that. And so it's a harder question to answer about do you have to take everything, but I think my presumption was you had to take, you were obliged to take this thing, the output. It was never an option. If it's an option, that's a completely different scenario. And the examples I thought we had in IFRS 10 were all about you have no choice in this matter. You've contracted to take half, you must take it. Now, you might be able to then flick it on to somebody else, but you're picking up all the responsibilities and all the risks that go with taking that half of the output. So it's not about, I won't take it, I will take it, I might take 80%. You had no choice.
Isn't it what you would need to make clearer is that if you set up those legal entities in order to deliver something under a contract, obviously you have to look at what this legal entity is, but if you can demonstrate that, you know, you are liable, you must respond to cash calls if there is need for cash calls and so on, this then could make it that this entity doesn't have substance per se, or you would go beyond the lead.
Yeah.
But you see, this type of discussion clarification is what people are asking, because at the moment it says right to the assets. So the way it is interpreted is that if you have a legal structure and you can't demonstrate, so you see, usually the legal structure makes a break towards rights on the whip. So the partners don't have rights on the whip. So if you don't have rights on the whip, you can't meet rights to the assets. And so therefore you default to joint venture. But from what you are telling me is that there might be situation, in the case I explained, for project entities where everything is set up before, you try to deliver a contract, you establish a legal entity afterwards, then you consider that in this situation, then you can overcome the substance, well, you consider that the legal entity doesn't have substance.
Yeah, and
that's why we are confused about how to read and how to apply.
I think Andrew alluded to in terms of IFRIC 4, because there may be situations where there are a couple of other scenarios we looked at, but there could be situations where you have very clear rights to some assets, and then essentially you've got a lease arrangement in there, and you've got, it's absolutely clear you've got that, but that's only some of it, and it might not be that you then have other responsibility for operating expenses and so on and employees, but you've got clear rights to some assets, and in those situations, I think presumptively in my head anyway, they were JVs, but with clear rights to some assets. What we're looking at for a joint operation is it's clear that you've effectively pierced the corporate veil for everything and it's been allocated out to the joint operators.
That's
unusual.
That was the qualification that I didn't hear last time, because you added the words for everything. So, and I think Tony brought us to the ability to pierce the corporate veil. Now, Alan is saying that in whatever circumstance, if you can only pierce it for one thing, and there are seven things in there, it's not good enough. You have to be able, now, I don't want to take it any farther than that, but the operative word is everything. And Alan is shaking his head for those of you who are just listening.
I don't understand this wording, pierce the veil, I don't understand.
Tony, you've been waiting to get in.
I sense that we are agreeing on some things, but there's also quite a lot of what the board meant coming out from what Alan's saying that isn't written down anywhere and people don't understand it. And I think this is the big challenge here. People really don't understand what other facts and circumstances means. I think where we all agree is that it's based on rights and obligations, and that rights and obligations can arise from contractual terms and they can arise from other sources. But I think people are not quite clear what the other sources might be, because you can set it up in a way that the agreement is completely silent, but the only way it can work is because it's created a right or an obligation, and I think we're probably all agreed about that. But then there are several things I think Alan has just said that I'm not sure everybody would look at it that way. So what Wayne just highlighted, you've got to pierce the corporate veil for absolutely everything sitting in there, and there must be a mechanism for allocating it back to the two or the three or the four parties. I'm not sure everybody would have looked at it in exactly that way. And so I think the tension that we have is that there is potentially a broad view about what other facts and circumstances means. And I think there are some people who are looking for guidance beyond simply, do you look at the contract or do you consider it more broadly? Because I think we've all got to you've got to look at it more broadly. It's the next step that people are struggling with. And I wonder if there's a way forward, at least in the short term, it's going to help people with that. This is one where I'm not sure simply saying it's too broad for the committee is going to help people, because they haven't at the moment got a framework to look at it.
Andrew and then Scott. John, we'll get you in too.
I was just going to say, when people talk about piercing the corporate veil, maybe it's my UK background, but that has a particular meaning for me, which means that creditors, claimants, can look through to the owners potentially for unlimited amounts. I don't think even having an agreement to take half the output at a price that's expected to meet the expected liabilities is the same thing as piercing the corporate veil. So maybe we're using the same term with slightly different meanings, but I'd be a bit, making me a bit uneasy.
We're using it exactly the same meaning.
Okay.
Scott?
Just to get back to what Alan suggested, or may have suggested, is rejection notice that at least clarifies view A, that there needs to be rights and obligations. I take from Marie's comment that she and I presume other regulators believe that that actually would be somewhat helpful. Is that
correct? I think it would be a step, yeah.
So I would support doing that, even acknowledging, it's clear from the discussion, that even clarifying that you got to look for rights and obligations, we don't exactly know what all of that means. And I've heard terms, Laurent, I think, said, concluding that the entity is non-substantive. I didn't think we needed to get that far in order to be a joint operation. In other words, I thought you could conclude the entity is substantive, but we still have a joint operation because of these other situations. And I wouldn't have thought you had to literally pierce the corporate veil, although if you could pierce the corporate veil, that'd probably be enough to convince me it was a joint operation. But I would have thought there'd be other situations as well. I think, the standard sets forth the example of the joint venturers, joint operators taking all the outputs. I assume that's a situation where, say, the joint venture is going to make stuff, it's going to sell X percent to you and X percent to you, and the price is cost plus 10%. Yep, I agree. That kind of sounds like the facts and circumstances that might lead me to conclude it's a joint operation. And that's without piercing the corporate veil or concluding that the entity is non-substantive. So I didn't think we had to go that far. But, I given what we've heard, I would go ahead and do a rejection notice that view A, rights and obligations, is what we're looking for. And then we might want to continue on to discuss to see whether we can do anything helpful in terms of that assessment. I'm not optimistic that we can, but heck, we haven't even tried yet, so I propose to go ahead and try.
Okay, that sets us up with a couple of different approaches, but we'll hold that for a minute. Martin?
I several times heard rights and obligations. I'm not sure whether we have this and or whether we have an or where's the borderline. Because specifically when I come back to this example with options, when we have a limited and you have a very, very bargain purchase price, for sure you would take this right, but what would be your obligation? Your obligation would be, okay, you could lose your interest in this JV or joint operation, but nothing more. You would have no obligation to fund it furthermore, and you would have no obligation to acquire the output. So would this lead to the conclusion that I would end up into another situation, which I assume, Alan, but I'm not sure. So if we are not sure about this, I believe we should have a kind of, say, interpretation guidance or whatever. If we end up in a situation where we say, oh no, we are all pretty sure what we mean and what IFRS does tell us, my question would be, where's the difference to a kind of educational material? So, because if we all have a quite firm view what IFRS tell us, why do we need to end up with an interpretation?
John?
I think Scott sort of fairly eloquently expressed sort of my sentiments. I mean, I think the issue here is whether IFRS 11 is clear about whether other facts and circumstances needs, it's still an assessment of rights and obligations. And I think we ought to do an agenda decision in line with view A, because I think that is helpful, because some people believe other facts and circumstances is something in addition to looking for rights and obligations. So I think that would help clarify. I think there's lots of other issues about that would help from illustration or education material as to what types of fact patterns where other facts and circumstances would give you a joint operation other than the ones illustrated in the standard. But that, for me, is something separate rather than the question that's actually before us, which I think would benefit from an agenda decision.
Reinhardt?
I was going to essentially say the same thing as John, coming from the perspective of a country where we've actually adopted IFRS 11. And so, you know, certainly predominant practice has been view A. That's the way it's been interpreted. And my concern would be if we were to say we need an annual improvement to come to view A, that that might lend credence to view B and cause a problem with what's been done in practice. And so having a long way around of saying a rejection notice supporting view A would be helpful in that respect. And agree, there's other issues that that are important that need to be addressed one way or the other. But just that that fact would be helpful.
Don, and then I'll go to the phones.
In discussing this issue with FRAD staff and ESMA staff before coming to the meeting, we had a lively discussion about it, but the one clear message I got was that, that we really wanted to get as much sort of concrete advice on IFRS 11 as we might be able to get. And I take on board what you said, Alan, about not creating uncertainty, but on the other hand, people are actually trying to think about what this means and to try to implement these things at the moment. So whatever we can get that would be concrete and that would help that, rather than perhaps waiting too long for a post-implementation review, even if it's brought forward, I think would be helpful.
Let's go to the phone. Sandy?
I don't have anything on this topic to add.
Luca?
Oh, thanks. My personal view is that the example made by Laurence clearly focuses the real problems that preparers are facing in the application of other facts and circumstances. I have exactly the same example on my table, and we have very long discussions inside and also with other, with our and other external auditors. And the response after this analysis has been that for the way in which nowadays is written IFRS 11, you have no chance to recognize this kind of structure as a joint operation, even though what Laurent said is absolutely clear, nothing has changed from another exactly same activities performed in another countries where not is requested to have an entity with a physical and local establishment there. So this gap is something that we were not able to fix with an interpretation, with a reading of the standards in order to fix the issue. And so the answer was that we are speaking about a joint venture in this case, even though from the perspective of the preparers, it is not the way in which the business has been designed, it's not the way in which the business is carried, it's not the way in which it's appropriate to present the financial results. As I said in the other occasion in which we discussed this topic, I'm very struggled because we are speaking about something, a standard that it is in place, but on which we have more than 25 points open that are all relevant, and it's difficult nowadays to find a practical solution that we should try to reach. If we go in our agenda paper nowadays saying that the standard is clear, is that the view correct is view A, my personal view is that we will close completely any door for a possible interpretation to go on the other aspect and say that there are other cases different from the example presented in the IFRS 11 relating to the acquisition of the all outputs. from the partners. If the board's intention was to create only one exception, we have to indicate that this is not an example, this is the only exception that you can have, and all the other cases are joint ventures. Otherwise, we have to work to not add additional guidance, but to work on the standards in order to better define what we want really to have to be included inside the other factor circumstances. Also to avoid to have the possibility to structure transaction, because I could be find someone that would be happy to have a joint venture when there is a big debt and a small about or earning before interest taxes, and at the same time it will be very happy to force the arrangement to have a joint operation in the other cases. I think that this is the issue. The example of Laurence is exactly the big issue that, especially in the construction entities, is on board. Someone has also problems because they have covenants, debts, relation with banks that are linked with figures that are more in line with a proportional consolidation, and they have to explain to the banks that nothing has changed, there is only an accounting effect, but my adding before interest taxes is a drop down of X percent. I think that in the way in which nowadays is written, unfortunately, the only cases that you can have is when you acquire all the outputs by the parents, and this is a proxy of the rights on the assets and on the liabilities. The strange thing is that you can have a design business that is exactly the same, but only from a formal point of view, you have a direct relation between the joint arrangement with the client, but the effect is from a business point of view, and I would like to have the same effect source in accounting, exactly the same. Unfortunately, from months of discussion, we were not able to reach this conclusion for the way in which it's written. I'm a little bit worried to take a tentative decision nowadays saying that the VUA is the only way in which you can reach the standards, because this will, in my opinion, close completely the possibility to make a step forward and try to see if there are other cases that are appropriate to recognize according to a joint operation.
Okay, Luca. Shelley, did you want to come in at all?
No, I've got nothing to add, thanks.
Okay, Alan, you wanted to come back?
It's more of a general thing about the other issues on the list, so if you want to wrap this one up first.
Oh, no, I'll have buy time. Go,
okay.
Go.
Okay, there are, I'm going to disagree with Luca a bit, there's a difference between people writing to us and asking for us to fix a whole lot of things, and then us going out and actively saying, have you thought about this? Is there anything you're not quite sure about? And I think, so we lowered the barrier for people telling us things. And we did, I'm a broken record. We did this for IFRS 3, got 72 issues, you know. Everybody told us everything that was possibly wrong. A lot of these things, I think, is about judgment, and we've got to go through this list carefully. But if I can ask the staff, the biggest thing for me is the separate financial statement issue, because it's a very important issue, particularly in Europe, for some jurisdictions that have taken that apply IFRS to separate financial statements. And I know we discussed that briefly last year, but we need to bring that back more sooner rather than later. So if we can prioritise that one, I think it's item 18, I can't remember if it was 18 or something. It's way down the list, but we need to give that a lot more speed. Now you've thought?
Luca's view, no, I haven't come up with anything that I hadn't come up with before. So. Luca's strong opinion notwithstanding, my sense was that a majority of the committee members say that reading the standard all in, all facts and circumstances, you get the VUA. and that we ought to issue an agenda decision on that point sooner rather than later. So can I have a show of hands, and Luca, I'll already count you as a no, unless you say otherwise, show of hands who would support that approach. All but one. So we have Tony and Luca essentially voting no on that one. The rest do.
Sandy, just
for Sandy, did you? Sandy, I didn't think was in the room anymore. Are you there, Sandy?
No, I'm here.
Oh no. Okay. Yes, I'm here. But okay. So which camp are you in?
I'm raising my hand.
Okay. All right. Now, one thing we frequently do is to say, okay, the staff hasn't had an opportunity to think about what an agenda decision would say. We'll bring it back. My sense from our friends in the regulatory corner over here is that it's more time sensitive than that.
It would be helpful to go faster.
So what I will propose is that with two volunteers to help the staff, we ought to try and write this and get it out and get it dealt with so we know, I think, what we want to say. So can I have two volunteers to help when he in his drafting? Scott? Come on, one more?
We have a guy, others on the other side.
Okay, that's two.
Can I ask one question?
Oh, by all means, two.
So we're going with UA. I think we're all agreed it's based on rights and obligations. Are we saying it's based on rights and obligations that come from the terms of the contract alone, or can rights and obligations arise from elsewhere?
No, I don't think.
Rights and obligations, rights to the assets obligations.
Right. That's the question I was going to ask, in which case I would stop my hand.
Okay,
UA says based on the contract terms.
In my simple-minded way, rights and obligations create assets and liabilities.
Absolutely.
That's why I, an hour ago, said I didn't think the word enforceable was necessary, because the definitions of assets and liabilities do not demand enforceability.
So all based on rights and obligations.
Right.
I'm happy with that. Okay.
And I don't want to complicate this, but I'm assuming.
Please don't.
You don't need to.
Okay. Well, I'll ask a question then. Are we doing any more? Because I did hear people say that. Yeah. However, that the committee also accepts that how those rights and obligations are created by other facts and circumstances could require significant judgment, and we'll continue to look at that issue or something like that.
I was going to do the sign of a brilliant person is the degree to which he agrees with you. I was going to call a break. I was going to call a break and ask us all, while we get coffee and bathrooms and everything, to think about what somebody used the phrase work streams. I think that was Don's favorite word here earlier. What the work streams are, because I did sense there's a real desire to do more here, but I haven't figured out how to do it. So let's all take 15 minutes and think about that, and then we'll come back. Is that okay with you, Lauren? Back at 25 minutes to the hour, then. Okay, let's start again. I think Michael has a cunning plan.
Yes, okay. Well, one of the things that I wrote down whilst committee members were speaking was a comment about a desire to see or to have more explanation about how and why other facts and circumstances create rights and obligations. And what I think could help us to do that would be to bring you to the next meeting some examples that we could use to try and illustrate how we think The other facts and circumstances can create rights and obligations. In doing that, in putting together those examples, we would draw on the issues 2, 3, 4, 5 that we had in this paper, plus if there are some other particular issues that you think on top of those we ought to be considering as well, then please let us know as soon as possible so that we could try and bring those as part of that paper. Now, connected with that, and one of the conversations I had during the break there was about certain there's certain structures, common structures that we see in practice that joint arrangements are conducted through, including the structure that was included on the November paper, the SCCV, also project entities as well. So if we could also do a paper on those to sort of illustrate the application, because all this I see as being illustration of the application of the other facts and circumstances guidance. So if we could bring those to you at the next meeting and sort of see how we can get to, potentially with a view to the committee developing some educational material, some examples that could then be published for use more widely.
Exposed and published, or what? To be determined.
To be determined, yes. We'll do one step at a time.
Yeah. Okay.